I do think that lawyers have a role to play in art and art history. And insofar as they help us to define what it is that we do, help us as artists to look, reflect upon ourselves, to define what it is that we're doing. And it's not a negative role. It can be a really positive, non-adversarial collaboration, if you will, on how art is defined. And that artists, a lot of artists, not all artists, it's a minority of artists, but some artists are very involved in doing things which are redefining what art is. And for some of those artists, a contract is a good way to help redefine that and to make clear this evolution that's constantly occurring in art.
Welcome to Warfare of Art and Law, the podcast that focuses on how justice does or doesn't play out when art and law overlap. Hi, everyone. It's Stephanie. And that was artist Ben Kenmont, whose creative career has spanned the gamut from painting to bookselling. He tells how economic precarity has become a sub-theme of his work after his street project in New York City and Cologne titled I Am For You, Ich Bin Für Sie, about alternative ways to think about sculpture, which involves speaking with over 11,000 individuals, many of whom voiced a similar concern, survival. This led Mr. Kenmont to curate a show in the mid-90s about artists' alternatives to the capitalist gallery system, titled The Materialization of Life into Alternative Economies. Mr. Kenmont was next inspired to create his ongoing publishing project, Antinomian Press, and his antiquarian bookselling business as an artwork, titled Sometimes a Nicer Sculpture is to Be Able to Provide a Living for Your Family. In addition to discussing each of these projects, Mr. Kenmont also tells how he was prompted to create Promised Relations, or Thoughts on a Few Artist Contracts, as well as his long-term project, Gastronomy and Economic Precarity, that encompasses such issues as the FBI's attack on the Black Panthers' free breakfast survival programs, and the sobering truth about prison food. In conclusion, Mr. Kenmont gives his thoughts on how one's role in cultural production can be used to create a more socially just world, how his work, Carl Andre Killed His Wife, could be considered the most blatant example of his work that addresses the issue of justice, and how he is creating a legacy through his art practice that might encourage others to experiment with what art can and cannot be, to address what needs to be said in their work, and to create a sustainable practice. Ben Kenmont, welcome to Warfare of Art and Law. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Stephanie.
Would you give an overview of the different avenues of your career?
I suppose it would be best to start. I've always been involved in art and around the art world because my father's an artist as well. And so when I went, when I sort of finished college and settled in New York City, I was already painting and making artwork. And I wasn't actually sure that I would do it professionally at that point. It wasn't until I was after being in New York City for a few years that I decided to really make it a career. But at the same time as making art in the city, I was also working for an antiquarian bookseller who specialized in early books on food and medicine and science. And it was after working with him for a while that I just decided to also start the bookselling business. But in fact, the bookselling business, when it began and was happening concurrently with my art career after having lived in New York for maybe 7 or 8 years, the bookselling business itself was actually started as an artwork, which was entitled Sometimes a Nicer Sculpture is to Be Able to Provide a Living for Your Family. So these were the two, one could say, the two professions that I was involved in simultaneously, starting in independently in 1998. But in fact, the bookselling business itself, although it was and is viewed as its own business, it is in fact, one could say, a subpart of my art practice.
Were you already familiar with occupational realism as a discussion then, or how did the decision to make bookselling as an art form, how did that come about?
I don't think that the term occupational realism existed at that point, to be honest. That's something that Julia Bryant Wilson coined later when writing that essay. The way that the piece came about, Sometimes an Answer Sculpture, came about is I had already done a piece out on the street. At this point, I was working in a lot of different media. I was making paintings, video, sculpture, photography, and I was also doing projects out on the street starting around 1990. And the first piece I did out on the street, which was called I Am For You, If Been For Z, because it happened in New York City and in Cologne. In Cologne also, because I had a gallery that represented me in Cologne as well. That project involved me handing out flyers on the street and talking with the public about three different basic ideas that were interesting me at that point. And the three ideas were Joseph Beuys's idea of social sculpture, which is the idea that between the individual and society, there's a sculptural relationship, that the individual is shaping society as much as society is shaping the individual. And that for Joseph Beuys, certain ecological and economic transformations needed to occur in order for what he said, every man to be an artist, by which he meant every person could be an artist. The other idea I was talking about on the street was the idea of something I coined called the thinking sculpture, which was sort of something that Joseph Beuys talked a little bit about, but also I had written my undergraduate thesis on William James. And William James and his ideas of radical empiricism and pragmatism spoke about the idea of the truth-making process and the reception of stimuli as one shapes an idea and it's reaffirmed through subsequent experience. And in a way, I was kind of approaching this idea of the thinking process as being a sculptural process, that one could talk about thinking itself, cognitive processes being a type of sculptural making, shaping process. So that was called the thinking sculpture. And then the other third idea was what I called the third sculpture, which was the idea of spaces in between. So the between two individuals out on the street, between two ideas, a dominant culture or in a subculture, that there's actually a space and that some artwork actually is generated out of this space in between. And so these three ideas, the social sculpture, the thinking sculpture, the third sculpture, were a kind of syntax to try to talk about an alternative way of approaching sculpture. And so when I was out on the street with this first project, I Am For You, in Cologne and in New York, at four different intersections in each city, during the period of the project out on the street of handing out the texts, we handed out and spoke with 11,750 people. And one of the things which struck me about that experience was that for many people, one of the most meaningful things for them in their lives was the simple issue of how does one survive? Kind of issues of economic precarity, how does one support oneself? And I'd always been interested in ways, in really understanding the ways in which we can consciously relocate where the artwork exists and how we define the artwork. So the traditional method would be, oh, it's the painting that's on the canvas, or oh, it's the object that's on the pedestal, or the photograph that's framed. But when more dynamic notions of sculpture and art have emerged, we begin to understand the way in which, in some ways, the artwork exists between people and how one interprets the piece and how meaning is created through the experience of the piece. Even people going back to like Christo will talk about when he does these big public projects, it's not, let's say, the running fence that goes across the Sonoma countryside into the ocean, but it's actually his discussions with the farmers, his discussion with the Coastal Commission, his community gatherings that he creates, that the artwork is really located in those social interactions. This is partly what Joseph Beuys was trying to argue with the idea of social sculpture. And so if one is willing to relocate the idea of where the work exists, then one can locate it into this more social space. And what that then requires is that one, as an artist, is clear about defining how that space functions and how one can understand that space as an artwork. And I think that while out on the street, what I realized was that one of the most kind of human basic issues, concerns that we have, that most of us have, is how do we survive? How do we support ourselves? And so I started to become more and more interested in that issue of economic precarity, and also the way that it really plagues and is such a difficult, very, very difficult issue for young artists who are starting out. And so I started to think about these issues, and a couple of things resulted. One was eventually the creation of the bookselling business as an artwork called Sometimes a Nicer Sculpture is to be able to provide a living for your family. So it's explicitly locating the artwork to the act of supporting one's family. But then also, I also created curated a show short about 5 years after that. So that in 1995, I curated a show called The Materialization of Life into Alternative Economies. And it was looking at different ways in which artists were working at notions of exchange that were alternative to the capitalist gallery system as a way to distribute and support their work. And that issue of looking at economic structures and different ways in which artists have worked with them, combined with the idea of just the basic principle of economic precarity and the difficulty of supporting oneself, led me to creating the bookselling business as an artwork. And so it has continued to exist since then. And I would have to say it's my most ambitious and difficult of all the artistic projects I've ever done is the actual running and setting up a bookstore. And this is why for many people, I'm thought to have two careers. One is that as an antiquarian bookseller, and then the other one as an artist. But in fact, the bookselling business is a project within my art practice.
Would you say the same is true of the Antinomian Press? It's all part of the same?
Yeah, definitely. So what happened was in 95 or so, I left all of my galleries that I was working with because the kind of practice I was going towards wasn't really conducive to what their purpose was and functioning within those spaces. And so when I left the galleries, a couple of things happened. I started curating, like the shows that I mentioned, but I also started publishing, and I realized that I realized that I really only needed about six people in the world that I was could be in dialogue with that were interested in the same issues as myself that I wanted to kind of like pursue this discourse or pursue this type of practice with. And I realized that actually the galleries were not necessary for the maintenance and support of that type of discourse I wanted. And so I started to publish things. I started to do these projects on the street, and I decided I'm just going to type out and my description of the project and the archive materials in the project, and I'm just going to send it in the mail to other like-minded artists and writers and thinkers, and so they can know what I'm doing, you know, just so I can stay in touch with them. And it worked really well. And I started then doing these types of publications for other artists about the work that they did, if it was related to kind of a project art practice. And then I started to do about historical figures. I would do research on archives and things that were I thought were relevant that had happened in the past that either were utterly unknown or they were a part of an artist's practice that was unknown when maybe there was another more famous part known and this wasn't what they were paid attention to for. So, and that's how the Antinomian Press started. And so that started roughly in 1996. So I leave the galleries in like 95. I start curating in 95. The Antinomian Press starts in 96 and the bookselling business starts in 98. And the Antinomian Press is an ongoing project. We've published over 250 publications now since then. And it includes everything from printed with lead type letterpress that's very sort of fancy to basic just photocopies that are handed out on the street. Some things have gone into, you know, more than 12 editions because they keep on getting reprinted. Sometimes students and other artists in other countries will reprint the publications or translate them into other languages, with my projects, anybody can recreate my projects or reprint my material. There's no control over that. But if they would like the material that's generated out of their reactivation of my projects, if they would like that to go into the archives of the projects, then they need to send it to me so I can look at it and then process this and put it into the archives.
Would the economic precarity be a common thread in the projects that you continued to do after that? Or was there a branching out from there in the projects that you focused on?
Economic precarity is always a kind of sub-theme on different levels, whether it be through my revealing the budget behind projects and letting everybody know what they cost so that there's like a realistic understanding of what is involved monetarily. But it also, but the projects also are very much about issues around art in everyday life, the what we can and can't call art, limitations of an artistic discourse. I've done projects that have to do with meaningfulness that's created privately in one's home and in domestic space, and where that, what that means, and is it possible to document and represent that in a museum space. I've done pieces that have to do with artists who pursue an art practice, but as they're pursuing a particular subject in their art practice, it suddenly leads them out of the art world and out of the art discourse. So it's not that they've given up on the theme or the topic, but the theme and the topic itself that they were pursuing as an artist necessitates them no longer calling it art. So issues of like the borders of where things can and can't be thought of as art and how and why are something that fascinate me. And then also just putting myself through that experience of like, you know, as artists, we usually seclude ourselves within the art world and the art discourse quite a lot. And it's always been important to me to be like out on the street or trying to justify an idea that I find immensely important to people who really don't give a shit at the beginning and maybe never will. But it's like, how do you go to somebody who has never been into a gallery or read about art history and say, all right, I'm going to talk with you about an expanded notion of sculpture that started with Joseph Beuys. I'm always kind of curious just to see what will happen and open these discussions up to critiques from people outside of our own discourse. The art world is very much about, it kind of assumes a level of consensus. And we usually operate within the galleries and museums. And when people go into galleries and museums, they have already consented. They've already agreed to have a certain type of experience, and they've expected to have an experience of some of a certain sort there. And that creates a certain level of consensus, as opposed to if you go out on the street and you're someone's walking to go to work, or some kids are hanging out on the sidewalk and it's their neighborhood and they kind of feel like they control that intersection, or there's a whole different range of values and purposes that are going on that you're actually interjecting yourself into. And how one deals with those other objectives and, if you will, values in those spaces in relation to one's own values that led one to being there are quite fascinating. And I think this is also why, like, what happened at one point, I had an interesting experience where I was invited to give a talk at NYU at the Draper Institute to a grad class in cultural anthropology. And I'd never spoken to such students before. And it wasn't until I had that opportunity that I realized that a lot of the issues that we face as project artists in doing this kind of work are not so disconnected with issues and sort of power structures, politics that anthropologists face when they're doing field work, because you're going out into other communities, you're trying to understand those places, you're trying to be conscientious of how you might affect what's happening there, and so on. And so I think that, whereas when I was younger, let's say the 80s and 90s, I would say that a lot of literary theory influenced how art was discussed, whether it be through deconstructionism or post-structuralism or maybe psychoanalytic theory. I would say with this type of practice, stuff that's written around subjects around anthropology are probably more relevant and interesting than trying to unlock and understand this kind of a practice.
What are some of the more surprising responses you've received when you brought the sculptural conversation into the social arena where it wasn't expected?
I think that, sometimes it's cultural differences. Like if you're doing such a project in the United States, it's different than doing it in Germany, for example. In the United States, there's a lot of advertising that goes on out on the street. And so a lot, or religious stuff. So a lot of the first initial barriers you have to get over are, I'm not trying to sell you anything, I'm not from a religious organization, and that kind of thing. In Germany, the difference with that first project, for example, was that everyone considers art as a very serious cultural thing, and artists also as a very, like, somebody, people with stature. And so in Germany, we had to overcome the stranger on the street feeling like he or she weren't qualified to have an opinion about what the content of the flyer was and trying to get them to talk. So some of the also surprising things have to do with things like people speaking about, like when I asked, had them speak with me about spaces in between, some of them would talk about the way in which those spaces are really where God exists. Like I had a Muslim who came up and was actually quite violent about it and really felt that this shouldn't be really discussed. And it's really because this is where God exists and that's supposed to be off limits. And I've had other people, I think quite rightly say that, well, if I understand you correctly, we could talk about this space and this dynamic between people in other terms as well. We could talk about it in terms of politics. We could talk about it in terms of religion. We could talk about it in terms of the social sciences. And I would say, yeah, I would say you're absolutely correct. I just happen to use a syntax that relates to art and art history because that's my background and where I, how I come to this.
I was curious about the process that then led you to your project, Promised Relations, or Thoughts on a Few Artist Contracts.
I started becoming interested in contracts when I started creating the archives. So in the early 90s, I realized that as an object, the best way to display and explain these projects to people within the art world was going to be through archives, because the archives have a premise of use value, right? They're not only a symbolic value like a lot of artworks are. The idea of an archive is that it's something that people handles. Usually it's something that people does research in. It's something that can be used for a purpose. I started working with archives because I wanted to have an object that I could show in galleries and museums that I felt comfortable with and that wasn't contradictory to the projects themselves. What I also wanted was I wanted the public to be able to handle the archives, and I wanted the owners of the archives to receive addenda to the archives that would be added by the collector or the institution so that the archives would be continually changing and expanding. Because really the projects themselves, the meaning of the projects, the nature of the projects, they change and expand over time. And so it may start out as one idea or meaning one thing, but then over time it may turn into, oh, this is actually quite interesting for this other reason. And so it becomes something else. And I felt that the archive was a good sort of structure that was easily understood by a lot of people. That could be an alternate idea of a sculpture, an alternate idea of a way for these works to circulate in the art world after the events have happened out on the street or wherever they were happening. So then this posed a problem, because galleries don't let people touch things normally. Museums certainly don't. And the collectors had to know that if people were handling and touching the materials, the collectors needed to know that that was my intention and that I was okay with that. And I needed to let them know what my expectations were on how this artwork would function as an object before their purchase. And so that's when I started researching artist contracts and different examples of how this was done. And the Promised Relations show was basically a selection of some examples of what my research found when I was doing research on artist contracts. So it includes works where the contracts themselves really are functioning contracts that are binding, as well as artworks where the idea of the contract was itself an artwork.
Of all the contracts that you came across, was there something about the ones that you chose that particularly resonated with you?
Well, I wanted to topologically have a wide range of different types of contracts. So some of them would there's lots of contracts that are binding and functional. Like I even got a hold at one point I was looking at Richard Serra's contract for the Tilted Ark, which caused that huge lawsuit and law case. I was looking at Felix Gonzalez Torres' contracts. At the time, Andrea Rosen represented him, and she was really keen on me including Felix in the show. But I realized that Felix's contracts were not really contracts as much as they were certificates. And there's a whole nother history of artist certificates that start with like Saul LeWitt and other people. And it wasn't, this show wasn't intended to be about certificates. It was really about a binding contract between two parties. So I wanted the contract to be as much as possible a recognition of two parties, or maybe even the signing of a document by two parties. So that was kind of, I wanted each of the types of contracts to be different, but then I also wanted it to span a certain number of years, so they would have a historical context to it as well. That's basically the reason I chose those that I did choose.
When you were at that point of needing a contract of your own, were you drafting one for yourself? Mm-hmm. I was just curious. Mm-hmm. The criteria that you included with yours.
So I wrote the contracts myself, but when I was working on the Promised Relations show, I also, through a family friend, was able to spend some time with Jerry Ordover, who was a really important art lawyer in New York City. He represented Ileana Sonovan and Leo Castelli Galleries. And he was kind of a seminal art lawyer in New York during that time period. The Pajansky Agreement, which Seth Siegelab initiated, was first something that Seth proposed to Jerry Ordover, and Jerry didn't have time to do it. So he kind of shuffled it off to Bob Pajansky, who was like a clerk or something working for him at the time. So Jerry was a really important person to talk to. And what I began to realize was that from talking to Jerry is that, and from my own readings, was that 90%, 98% of the purpose of a contract, certainly an artist contract, I think, that I saw and that I valued, was the contract would help to get both parties on the same page. That it was I saw it as a kind of declarative statement that made clear how things would function. And it gave the person signing the contract an opportunity to express what their concerns were around how things might function. So it was kind of like a tool to facilitate communication between two parties. And I felt that it was a way to be, that was like the basic function of it. And then the other part of it was, in my case, as an artist, it was a means by which I could be clear about how the artwork was defined and how it functioned as an object up to that point and how it would continue to function as an object. Because you've got to realize in contemporary art, there's a lot of new ideas being experimented with continually about where the artwork is located and what actually is the artwork and what you're actually buying. And so I wanted to use the contract as a means by which to define what the artwork was, much in the way that someone might define an artwork through a photograph. Here's the painting. There's the photograph. Or an art historian might write a description of the artwork. There's the description of the artwork. But I wanted to use the contract as another layer on which one could understand what the artwork was and where it was located. And of course, it was also a good document to use as the definition of the artwork was expanding itself into the more social field, into the more social space. So, and it also, of course, on some level too, was to kind of also make really clear, hey guys, you know, this is what I expect. I expect you to let people touch this. I expect you to let people handle it. I expect you to add new things to it. And I wanted to let the collector know you're moving into this territory now. I want to make it really clear. Just because you bought this doesn't mean you get to take the archive, for example, and break it up and sell all the different pieces. Or it doesn't mean you suddenly get the right to frame everything and put it on the wall as though it's like a photographic artwork of that event. So it was important for me to use it as a tool, almost in a kind of like epistemological sense, as a way to define how we understand something and what it means and how it functions in our discussion about it. And what I learned from Jerry Ordover was that it's very, very rare that actually lawsuits occur and things start to play out in the courts due to a contract of this nature. And he mentioned, you know, that really, you know, the contract can be used and have a lot of function before they ever even get to that level. Even though one is, in a sense, writing them for that point, at the same time, that's really not, in many ways, if you define the function of a contract as being how it's most often used, that is not how it's most often used.
That prompts me to ask how collectors reacted to being asked to sign this contract.
It depends on the person. Some of them are really concerned, like MoMA, Department of Prints and Drawings, bought the Antinomian Press Archive for their collection. But what blew my mind about that was they made very clear that they'd never in their entire history as a museum purchased something which they knowingly purchased, or rather that they purchased knowing that it was going to change while in their possession. I mean, of course, things do change in their possession, but they never bought it knowing that it was going to change and with the intention of it changing. So it was a very bold and difficult thing for them to do. And they did balk at the contract, and they were like, well, how do we know you're not going to just suddenly show up with a car and say, hey, this is part of the archive? And I said, well, you don't, but I can tell you that I can't imagine there's any purpose for me to put a car into the Antinomian Press archive. So, and also you have to realize what comes with the archive too, and the purchase of the archives is a complete inventory list of all the contents. So I know that this is a nightmare to the museums, and especially for the registrar department, people who work really hard to do all the paperwork. And so when I go in there, actually the registrars have a huge sigh of relief because they see my inventory list, and it's actually even more detailed than what they themselves produce. So they're able to almost always just cut and paste and copy what it is that I've done for them. So I'm not trying to be an asshole to the institutions. I'm really trying to work with them. I'm just trying to change their function. I'm trying to change what they see as what's possible. And I'm willing to work with the mechanisms that they already have in place. I'm just trying to alter where they view the artwork as existing and what the possibilities are.
It seems that there's a general population of artists that shy away from contracts. Your thoughts on that, or if you've had conversation about that with artists where you've seen the reasons why?
Well, I think there's a lot of reasons why for that. I mean, I think part of it is that a lot of people who become artists are not comfortable with writing and reading things critically, like a contract. And so they're just not comfortable with it I used to teach graduate school, and I remember being amazed at how many artists are at grad school and they have profound difficulty even writing a paragraph. So I think part of it is that there might be a higher percentage of people in art programs who just aren't comfortable with writing and reading that kind of language. I think it also has to do with the modernist tradition of the artist as sort of visionary, who's separate from society and has his or her own experience and view of the world, and that contracts are a bit too mundane to be dealing with. And also explaining things clearly is not something that a visionary artist should have to do. So there's a kind of cloak of mystery that some artists really like to maintain and hide behind. And I say that obviously in the tone I'm using is I'm kind of critical of that, which I am. But on the other hand, I will also admit that there are, you know, not everyone should have to do that. I mean, there's, you know, some people like to not give interviews. Some people like to not explain what they're doing. And a contract is a form of explanation, right? And so I think some artists stay away from it just because they draw some of their power and ability, inspiration, whatever one wants to say, from not being totally explicit about what it is that they're doing, leaving it open for interpretation. So I think that's part of the reason why artists shy away from it. And also they probably feel like they could get screwed. You know, they don't know that people are really looking out after them, and they can feel that you got to remember, like they may, again, like I said, even with my own projects, it might start out as meaning one thing and it becomes something else. So when you put it into writing, some people feel as though that limits what it might become or how it might be understood. And so I think that's part of the purpose. I don't personally, I just see this as another thing to make. Writing of contracts is another form of making. It's a form of making. It's a tool that you can utilize to your advantage and to help you yourself as an artist understand what it is that you've done and how you want it to function. When I used to teach grad school, I used to often talk to my students about, hey, look, you guys need to think about where you're locating the artwork. And I don't mean just physically, it's about a pedestal or hanging on the wall, but what is the artwork? When you're in an art practice, what is it that you're making that you're interested in? And realizing that that will evolve as it changes, just like you might be a fan of modern literature and you might start out with a certain group of authors that you think are fantastic. And as you study and read them more, your interest and understanding evolves and you move into a different group of authors. In your own practice, you can start out with a certain idea of where your artwork is located. And then you realize, oh, actually, that isn't what I meant. What I meant was this instead. And so, I don't know. So for me, I think that, I think it's just for me, you know, I think that making a contract is just another form of a structure by which you can understand your work. And truth be told, it's not so different than a museum itself or a gallery. And so far as those spaces also define the meaning of your work, you can just choose or not choose to be conscious of the degree to which they do that, but they do define the meaning of those of that work. You take a Marcel Duchamp piece and you show it in a at Coney Island, along with all the other games that are there, it's going to read and be understood in an entirely different way than if you're looking at a Philadelphia Museum. Spaces define the pieces. They define our experience of them, how we understand them, the discourse that we use for them, how we remember them. Contracts are just another way of doing that.
Yeah. And bringing up Duchamp brings to mind the Exhibition in Your Mouth project. I believe it was the recipe he had was steak tartare on the menu. Would you describe how that came about and the evolution of that project?
Yeah. So what happened was I had done a piece in 1990, 91, something like that. That was where I invited strangers to come into my home to have a waffle breakfast. And the piece wasn't really about the food. It was about the idea of trust as sculpture. And when I did that piece, Rick Richter of Indonesia, who was a friend of mine at the time, was also doing stuff related to food in the city. And I wanted to kind of do a historical show about artists working with food. And so I ended up curating that show that went, the earlier iterations of it went from the futurists to the fluxist artists. So covering most of the 20th century. And I wanted to kind of just, because when I start working on an idea that is really important to me, or I've done a piece or a few pieces about it, I like to then do research on, hey, who else has worked on this? And what did they figure out? Or what were the problems that they faced? Or just to kind of, in a sense, it's like knowing my discourse. If one is doing something that's more alternative and unusual, it's really important to have some points of reference. I think it's true for any kind of discourse that is not in the consensus, any kind of discourse or experience that's not part of the existing power structure. It's important that you understand and know your history. It's important that you know your archives, so to speak, who came before you. And it helps you to create a power structure and a discourse around your own experience if you've had that. So when I'm doing these pieces on the street or other places, I am often thinking, well, who else has done this? Or who tried to do it, but it didn't work out or whatever. All of my shows are actually done in that sense. When I did the contract show, it was for that same reason. Materialization of Life into Alternative Economies, same reason. So with the Exhibition in Your Mouth, you know, there were some artists, some of us in New York at that time, early 90s, were working on the idea when we're playing around with food and social space as part of our artwork. And I wanted to kind of show a historical context for that in development in that. And then, and every time I come up with an idea to do a show or to do a theme, to do a topic, I then think, okay, well, what structure should it take? Should it be a publication? Should it be a physical show? Should it be an action on the street? And in this particular case, I thought this should be a dinner because it's basically, these are all recipes, right? And so that, and I like the idea that the exhibition space becomes your mouth. And so that was the idea. So when I selected those recipes, they needed to be artist recipes that were actually edible. There's a lot that aren't. It needed to be one that was edible. It needed to kind of fit as a menu. you know, a starter, a middle, a final course, a dessert. So I had to kind of structure the show that way. And it had to be attainable, you know? And so that was the first idea for that show, was that, you know, you would in effect eat the exhibition.
What was the feedback that you received? And you said the initial, it started with strangers, and then from there you had, how did the invitation list go and their feedback?
So that project was first shown in a frac in Montpellier. And I guess 2002, and it was basically whoever came that night to the opening, I think, as I recall. I can't remember if you had to have an invitation or not. Maybe you did. I don't remember, but there were maybe 40 people or something. And on that iteration, I did all of the cooking of all of the recipes. There was a cooking school in Montpellier that was closed for vacation or something, and I got access to the kitchen and used it. Pretty much all of the other subsequent iterations, and this exhibition's been recreated now 7 or 8 times. And each time it got recreated, I would work with another chef, and I became more of kind of overseeing it as opposed to actually doing the work in the kitchen. And the receipt that's been a really popular project, almost too popular, because I don't want to become a caterer to the art world or something. I only redo the project if there's something really different about the demographics or the city, the place that I'm doing it. Cause you know, everyone loves to eat and think about food. So
I believe I've heard you say, or perhaps you'd written this, that the study of gastronomy has social and political meanings. And I was curious if you could expand on that.
So, right. So when I started the book selling business project, I had to pick a subject, and I was interested in gastronomy partly because my mom had written a cookbook when I was growing up, but also there were no great dealers in the United States handling early books about food and wine. And I had studied American culture studies as an undergraduate. And so when you approach this subject from an American studies background, it's very interdisciplinary. American studies is very interested in like the history of private lives, material culture, subcultural studies, themes which are now, we didn't use the term back then, but nowadays we refer to as intersectionality, where you have the crossover between two different histories or discourses and issues, or multiple, not just two. And gastronomy is a really good one for that, because it deals with women's studies in a lot of ways. It deals with economic history, it deals with sort of ethnography, it deals with class, a whole bunch of issues, medicine, health. And after working on this for many years, well, actually, let me say one other thing. The other issue about the subject matter I chose for the bookshop is that it was also very parallel to what I was doing in my art practice. Because in my art practice, I was doing pieces about washing dishes, serving food, about leaving the institutional space and going into private space. So in a way, there was a thematic connection also. But what I realized after, because I've been doing this project now for over 30 years, what I realized after doing this for 20 years or so was that almost all of the exhibitions about the history of gastronomy, all the histories, history books, the collections that are formed by institutions and so on, really focus on what we could probably call haute cuisine, like the food for the top 1% of the population. And then I became more and more interested in the emergence of soup kitchens, food policy that would allow food to be affordable for the broader population, how prisoners were fed, different issues around food for the rest of the population, and not only for the wealthiest. And this, for me, I had to come up with a term to coin for this, and I ended up calling it gastronomy and economic precarity. And because I also was realizing that just because you're not a millionaire doesn't mean that you don't have a developed sense of gastronomy or a sense of food. It's just that your access to certain types of preparation and ingredients would be different, and where you eat and how you eat and how often would be different. And so I started to really actively search out and look for those types of books in the history of gastronomy. And it's really been a chore, but I've gotten a number of research institutions to start buying in the field to make the materials available to their researchers at the universities and to start talking about it a little bit more. And this has been really rewarding, and it's really been fun because it's sort of like, and I hate to say it, but it's sort of a little bit like groundbreaking work in a whole new field of gastronomy, because no one's done this before. No one's kind of wrapped their head around it. So that's been kind of something I've slowly focused on more and more in the last 10 years.
Are there any of those resources that come to mind that you've come across?
Sure. I mean, one that we're working on this week is, you know, the Black Panther Party started the free breakfast program, and they announce it. It starts to be available at the end of January 1969. And the Black Panther Party create a lot of programs they call the survival programs. The free breakfast program is the first one. And they come up with a quick understanding that if our children don't arrive to school well fed, how could they possibly learn? And so they start to create this free breakfast program, and it becomes super popular and spreads around the chapters around the United States. So popular that the FBI get frightened about it being the means by which the Panther message would be spread in the United States. And they actually start literally destroying and attacking these centers and trying to end the program. And so that's one example. I also had an amazing experience where an inmate on death row at San Quentin about 5 years ago reached out to me and knew that I sold cookbooks and said, I've just written a cookbook. It's called the Death Row Cookbook. And it talks about final recipes and final dishes. And it talks about, he got recipes from other people on death row. That type of cookbook is understood within a genre called community cookbooks, which is a special subgenre within cookbook literature. I don't normally deal in anything that's contemporary, but of course this was amazing, and I was happy to. And so we started selling a large number of copies of this book for him. So it's kind of like just trying to get ourselves to understand the way in which food exists within people's lives. And it isn't only in these sort of precious, expensive restaurants, but that we all eat and therefore have a different idea about food. And, Mr. Jones, who wrote that cookbook, you know, he also talked about food in general within prisons and the different prisons he'd been in and what the food policies are, which was fascinating because most of us don't know. I certainly didn't know how that worked. And it's pretty awful, actually.
Is the Death Row Cookbook still available?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Through your Antinomian Press?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, through the bookstore. Yeah. But actually, I think if you were to go onto Amazon, you could also find it, to be honest. So, I mean, I sell to institutions, I sell lots of copies. Like, I'll get the institutions to know about it and they'll order it from me. But to be quite honest, it can also be ordered online as well.
For this project, I believe you said it was gastronomy and economic precarity.
Gastronomy and economic precarity, yeah.
Do you see that project and or any of your others as addressing injustice?
Sure. Yeah, sure. I would think so. I mean, I think it's just trying, I think that booksellers can are involved in cultural production insofar as they're getting people to pay attention to certain things, right? So I have an audience, so to speak, right? I sell, you know, maybe 75% to institutional customers, and they read my catalogs and they come up with their understanding of the history of food through my catalogs in part, right? And when you bring, and I explain things, I give ideas of why one book is more important than another and what was going on historically at the time. The books then get purchased, they get valued, we create monetary value on these materials, we decide what book is worth $2,000, what book is worth $1,000, and so on. We're involved in creating value around cultural products. So one could say that we're involved in cultural production. Insofar as we're involved in cultural production, we can also direct cultural production in a particular direction, right? And I think, and a good example is my interest in gastronomy and economic precarity. That term hadn't existed before. These institutions weren't buying that material before. Now they're starting to buy it. And so I think that you can, as an artist or even as a bookseller and as a person involved in cultural production, you can kind of direct people's attention to certain topics. You can also be conscientious about issues around ethics around your practice. I've also worked on a text, which has gone through numerous editions now with my grad students when I was teaching at CCA, which was called Ethical Considerations in Project Art Practice. And I was trying to get the students to really think in ethical terms about what their projects were about and what was occurring. One can think about, you know, one can be a more or less ethical bookseller. One can deal with, you know, with social justice and be selling books that deal with that subject matter, bringing them to people's attention. And so in this way, I think, yes, one can help towards creating a more socially just world through one's practice, either as a bookseller or as an artist.
And would you have, or over the course of your career, has there evolved a definition of justice that you would give?
That's a big one. I don't know that I'm the one to say that. No, I don't think it's, I don't work as a bookseller or artist with a definition of justice. No. It's a case by case situation. I mean, I think that, it's a complicated issue. I mean, for example, it's really complicated. I mean, you may have seen, I don't know if you saw in the book Prospectus, but one of the first pieces I did was this piece that has plastic letters on the wall that say Carl Andre killed his wife. And that was a court case that was going on at the time in New York City, and where he was accused of having pushed Anna Mendetta, who was also an important artist, out the window. And he was arrested, taken to court, and he took the fifth and was acquitted. But what was important for me about the piece at the time was that the way in which the art world rallied behind Carl Andre, and most of the people that I knew were all believed that he was guilty, and yet no one was going to say anything about it. And I felt like it needed to be said. You know, I thought that somebody, as an artist, that it needed to be brought forward. And what was interesting was that, and it was just plastic letters on the wall that said that. And what was interesting was that an artist named Olivier Mousset bought the piece, and it was maybe the first piece I ever sold, or one of the first pieces. And then Olivier became friends with Carl Andre later and wanted to trade it for another earlier artwork of mine, because he wanted to have an early piece of mine, because he didn't want Carl to know that he owned the piece. And I told Olivier that that was fine, but that the description of his trading of the piece would become part of the new piece, would become part of the work. And so every time that work is exhibited now, it includes my description of Olivier trading the work. And so, you know, so this whole idea, again, that's a good example of the way in which the meaning of a piece can evolve over time. And, you know, and in terms of, you know, justice, I mean, I kind of, you know, at the time, the evidence that was being reported on it, in the press, because it was in every newspaper and everyone was talking about it in the art world, it was like a public event, really. All of the evidence to, you know, sounded like this had occurred, and to me and to many others. And the thing about Carl Andre was, he was a really important artist for me in some ways, because he was involved in the Art Workers Coalition group. He had made artwork that was about opening up the art discourse through the use of proletariat materials, like stacks of bricks and this kind of thing. And he was, for many artists at the time, was something of a hero, you know, and to have a figure like that who was about accessibility and opening up the discourse, have, you know, be involved in this incident, have this occur, is pretty, was really awful, really terrible. And, but in a way, I also did another piece at the same time called You, Carl Andre, Me. And it was also, for me, it was almost like a parable, insofar as it was a very good example of the way in which the artist as visionary, or the artist as this person separate from the regular rules of society, can also fuck up, it can go too far. And I think that, I mean, I grew up in an artist household, and it's difficult when you're an artist to maintain healthy interpersonal relationships, and to not be violent, or to not be overly narcissistic, and so on. And I think that all of us as artists have that in us. Maybe all people do in general. But so in a weird way, the Carl Andre case, that's why I did the piece, You, Carl Andre, Me, because it was to refer to the fact that we are all, in one sense, we are all Carl Andre. And that's how parables function, right? They depict something which is essential to human existence, human behavior. And so in a sense, I felt like that case was like a good reminder about the side of what it is to be an artist that shouldn't be forgotten when understanding art. And so that was part of my purpose of doing that, even though we can say these great things, as Carl Andre did quite eloquently, and make these great works as he has done. But at the same time, there's this other side that needs to be addressed. And of course, the fact that it was, you know, a very famous male artist and a younger woman artist who was becoming really important in the art world at that time. There were a lot of gender issues around it that were awful as well. I felt like it just needed to be addressed. And so I suppose one could say that's the most blatant piece I've ever done about justice. it was just very important for me for really personal reasons, even though the piece doesn't sound so personal. That, I mean, there were the two pieces, that one doesn't, the other one does, but it is it's an important question, you know, what do we say and do as an artist? And that's where we are within the art discourse. I think we're at a point in the art discourse where the decision, where the artwork really exists on the level of what decisions do we make? Because the field is wide open right now with what we can do as artists. So the question then falls on our shoulders as, what decisions do we make as artists?
With all of the projects that we've been discussing throughout your career, what is the legacy that you hope to be creating with your work?
I don't know. I've never thought about legacy. I would go so far as to say I hope that I'm encouraging others to experiment with what art can and can't be, and to be aware in their own minds and their own perception of how that meaning is created. I think also for me, I think it's important that art respond to a certain level of urgency. And so if there's something that's important that needs to occur, that needs to be said, one should do it and pursue it, independent of what it means in terms of your career, in terms of yourself as a brand, in terms of yourself as somebody worth speculating on financially. I think that it's important to follow what you feel is urgent and how something needs to evolve or change. And I think that, you know, what I always tell my students, one of the issues when I was teaching grad school, that I would always try and say is, I'd like, look, you guys, I encourage you, because if the students were in my class, they were already doing stuff that was pretty alternative. So I would say to them, look, I would encourage you with your practice, with your more radical or alternative practices, I would encourage you to figure out a way to do this for the next 70 years. Don't think about it in terms of just this year or getting out of grad school. You need to come up with a practice that is sustainable for a longer period, because so many artists pursue these types of practices and burn out. They go into debt. No one will loan them money anymore. They end up with families and they can't go on vacation because they can't afford it. They don't have insurance. This was before the Affordable Care Act. Come up with an idea, or watch yourself as you're practicing as an artist, and come up with a way to do this for the long haul, because it's important that we do this for the long haul. So I would say that, you know, that's probably why I started the book selling business, to allow me to pursue things on a level of seriousness and intensity, even if there's no monetary function or monetary payback that's going to occur, but I can still pursue these ideas if I need to, if I want to. That's really important for me. And I encourage other artists, and I hope perhaps my history, my story, might encourage other people that it's okay. You know, it's okay to leave those galleries or leave those museums and do stuff in alternative spaces and make your own history.
There will be links in the show notes to learn more about Mr. Kenlont and Antinomian Press. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can subscribe on your preferred platform. And if you'd like to support more episodes like this, it would be much appreciated if you could leave a rating or review. You can also leave your comments online and tag Warfare of Art and Law Podcast, email me at Stephanie@warfareofartandlaw.com, or leave a voice message at 1-929-260-4942. And the podcast Patreon page has rewards for those interested at patreon.com/warfareofartandlaw. Until next time, this is Stephanie Draughty bringing you Warfare of Art and Law. Thank you so much for listening. And remember, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. What are your plans for the second Saturday of this month? Perhaps consider joining in for a discussion about art, culture, and social issues. Hi everyone, it's Stephanie, and every second Saturday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, I host the Second Saturday Art and Justice Gathering, an online call that explores a range of topics, from artists who might inspire to legal decisions that might infuriate, all with the aim of sparking dialogue about social justice and promoting creative thinking. If interested, please email me at Stephanie@warfareofartandlaw.com.